So even this last year, there had been some amazing advances in technology, and especially in the area of space exploration. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm a sci-fi nerd. Do I have any friends in the place? Any sci-fi nerds in here? That's right. We are the people that if you get something wrong and call something Star Trek when it's really Star Wars, we will correct you. That's who we are. But I love sci-fi movies and anything because I love how when I watch a sci-fi movie, I see how kind of technology kind of catches up to that. Well, how many remember the movie Armageddon? Okay, all right. So we know that didn't really happen, right? It's a movie, okay? Bruce Willis didn't find himself on a comet or an asteroid. But what's funny is that sending a probe to a comet, we just accomplished that last November. We launched a spacecraft and put it on. Now, Bruce Willis wasn't in the spacecraft, mind you, but that's an amazing accomplishment. We've never probed a comet before, and so we actually landed. It was kind of a slight crash landing, but hey, give us credit, right? That's pretty amazing. And then as we speak, hurtling around at 17,000 miles an hour, the International Space Station, there's two men on the International Space Station, Scott and Mikhail. And one cosmonaut, one astronaut, these men are going to be living on the International Space Station for 1 year. That's an amazing thing. Now, why would we even talk about that? Why is that even a big deal? Because we're preparing what the future may hold of maybe possibly sending someone, a man, woman, or maybe a pastor to Mars. I'm holding out hope a little bit. And so, I mean, Mars needs Jesus too, right? So they're learning on what happens to the body as in long durations in space. And so they're figuring that out. So with all this technology advancement, with all this kind of things that we're advancing and exploring and we're discovering, who needs God? I gotta say, we're going to be talking about that even from the standpoint of as we begin to dive in deeper into this understanding of all things that are being explored, and the more we get to understand, in my opinion, I believe, the more God reveals himself to us. And so we've been in this series called Who Needs God? Now, the interesting thing about last week, we talked about the idea that if there is no God, you and I are just chemistry, biology, controlled by physics. There is no mind, there is no free will, no justice, and no value. That the source of all these is from the fact that we are sourced and made in the image of God. And so we talked about that there. We believe, we asked the question, who needs a God? Well, we said, well, humanity needs God. Humanity needs God. Now today, we're going to be going in a little bit different direction, and I hope you remember high school biology and science and all that. We're going to be talking a little bit about that, and just again, give you a disclaimer. I am not a scientist. My degrees are not in biology, psychology, or philosophy. They're in theology. But about 14 years ago, I was so enamored by a book, and that we'll talk a little bit later, that I started diving into this because I begin to see that some people need hard evidence to see that there is a God. And so I, as we talk about science a little bit today, and I hope you stay with me and not fall asleep like you did on your science professor in high school, but as we talk about that, there is a tension between Christianity and science. There is a tension. I don't know if you felt that or if you've thought of that or maybe there is no tension. You're like, what tension? I just came to church this morning. I don't know about any of that. But however you see that, there is a tension. And the reason why I say there's a tension because in growing up in elementary school, I went to both a Christian school for a time and I went to a public school for a time. And in college, I went to a Bible school for a time and I went to a secular university. So half my credits are in both. And so I got to see a pretty broad spectrum of two different ways of looking at science. And so it was fascinating to me. But there is a tension. And if you're a Christian, maybe you were raised with this thing that, oh, scientists are actually, they're about trying to disprove God. Or if you're a person that's a thinking person, you're, you know, maybe you're a scientist here today. Maybe you're a little suspect of Christians because you think sometimes they turn off their brain. I'm here to say, Let's talk to the Christians. If you're a Christian and you're suspect to science, I understand why you are. I understand why there's the tension there. And the reason is because science doesn't say anything scientists do. Science only is the observable evidence. It's scientists that interpret the data. And as you all know, we all have a level of biasness. We all do. As objective as you and I try to claim to be, that we all come from a place of biasness. And just to let you know, quickly was polled of the scientists that are in America, and there's a 60-40 split. 60% are agnostic or atheist, and 40% are Christian. Now, if you're sitting to think, well, that's kind of a recent phenomenon, it's not actually not. 100 years ago, the split was exactly the same, 60-40. And so what you have here is sometimes you have a biasness away from the supernatural and more to what can be explained with reason and material. And so there's this kind of biasness away from that, and sometimes there can be agendas by scientists. Now, I'm not just claiming all scientists have an agenda. I definitely don't want to say that, but there is sometimes an agenda. And there's even been stated that science can, in its own right, sometimes be looked upon even as its own religion. So there's a level of biasness. But I think as a Christian, you shouldn't be scared of science. You shouldn't be scared of science. You shouldn't look at your science book and go, well, don't need that. I think we need to, as Christians, as we begin to dig down, and I hope to prove some of that today, as we dig down and see, the more we understand about science, the more it shows us how amazing truly God is and how he created everything. Because God and science are not competing explanations for the universe and life. They're not competing. Both are necessary. And let me give you an example. Henry Ford and the laws of internal combustion are not competing explanations for the Model T, right? In fact, learning about how a car works will never disprove the existence of the car maker. And so God reveals himself to you and to I, both in two different kinds of books. He first reveals himself to us through the Bible, and then he also reveals himself to us through the book of nature. And the Bible, he revealed himself to us through this amazing story from Genesis to Revelations of an amazing God going after a prodigal people. That's the story we find in scriptures. But we also see God's evidence everywhere in nature. And the more we dig down, the more it points to not disproving there's a God, but actually nature proves that there is a God and he really does exist. Are you ready with me? So we're going to be looking at three evidences. Now, there's a lot of different evidences, but honestly, I only have a few minutes. So we're going to talk about three primarily evidences, and in those primarily evidences, we're going to even go a little bit deeper into one example in each. And the first we're going to start off with the three evidence in nature. The first one is the beginning of the universe. The beginning of the universe. Now, Dr. Turek, he said this. He says, the Big Bang, now I know right now I've just lost some of you because I just said Big Bang in church. And you're thinking, oh, I've been in the wrong church. Now, hold on now. Before you throw something at me, the Big Bang has a lot of baggage. Dr. Turek is a Christian. He's not using the Big Bang from an evolutionary standpoint. He's using the Big Bang as explaining a singularity or an event. Now, as Christians, you believe that creation happened as an event in time, do you not? And so he's talking about the Big Bang as a singularity. So if Big Bang really messes with your mind, just put singularity in its place, or singular event in time. He says the Big Bang singularity cries out for a divine explanation. It forces the conclusion that nature had a defined beginning. I cannot see how nature could have created itself. Only a supernatural force that is outside of space and time, that's huge, could have done that. And so if you don't believe in God, then you're left with just two options. The scientists, they're kind of divided. There was a lot of scientists of that 60% that believed that it was a Big Bang, but now they're starting to reconsider the Big Bang. The reason why they're reconsidering the Big Bang is because something, they're saying this can't happen, that something came from no thing. Something came from nothing. That doesn't happen. And so they're reconsidering that, thinking that the universe is eternal. Now, this is an interesting thing, because as Christians, we believe God is eternal, do we not? And yet we're called stupid, that we believe God is eternal, and yet to believe that the universe is eternal. So there's two different camps. There's some scientists that believe that it happened, but the problem is something had to initiate the bang. You know, I believe it was said, God said, let there be light, but that's another thing. So the atheist, as far as Richard Dawkins would say, he would say this, cosmology is waiting on its star when he says, just give it enough time. And we have, again, Richard Dawkins has put in a lot of faith in people to understand where we came from. So either the universe is static or it happened from a void. But as Christians, we believe that God initiated the creation. And so the evidence right now, there is a lot of evidence pointing to an expanding universe. Now hang with me. This idea of the expanding universe, because why do we want to see that there's an expanding universe? Because if the universe is expanding, it means that it came from a singular event. If the universe is static, it would not be expanding. Would you agree? Like, I don't know if I could agree or not, but I'll go with you, Crispin. All right, so here's some evidences for an expanding universe. First of all is the second law of thermodynamics. Thank you, Carnot, Joule, and Clausius. The universe is running out of usable energy. Now, the first law of thermodynamics says that the tank is full and the car is running fast. Our second law is that the car is running fast and soon the universe will run out of steam. If it's running out of steam, that means it had from a singular point. Then Albert Einstein. Anybody got Albert Einstein fans in here? Okay, four people. That's awesome. In 1915, came up with the theory of relativity, right? But now this is, again, where I talk about people having a biasness. Albert Einstein was not a Christian. I know that he was younger, but he became an atheist. He did not believe in God. And yet, him in his work, he believed that the universe was static. And so his theory of relativity, he was trying to actually disprove and actually proved that the universe is expanding. He proved that matter and time and space all have to coexist at the same time. He proved in 1915, and so he did his mathematical equation, and he actually fudged the numbers. It's called the famous fudging of the numbers. He did try to divide zero because he was so upset with what he would say. He didn't want it to be a singular event. He didn't want the universe to expand. But then 10 years later, a Russian mathematician actually proved his theory to be a general law, now proven to the fifth decimal place. And then Edward Hubble came along and asked Albert Einstein to come and look through his telescope, because Edwin Hubble confirmed that the general law of relativity to be true, looking through the telescope. And what he saw in the telescope is called a red shift. He saw the evidence of the universe expanding. And then in 1978, Justin was born, but not only was Justin born, if you wanted to know, Penzias and Wilson, radio astronomers, actually discovered, as they were listening, I don't fully understand how you'd listen, but they could hear the radiation wavelengths. It would be as if you dropped a pebble in a pond and the wavelengths that would happen, that would form that. And they could hear that, as radio astronomers could. And so they said that there's this expanding of the universe. And so we put up a satellite in 92, then 2003 and 2013 that only confirmed that to be true. Now, why is this huge? Robert Jastrow probably puts it best in his book, God and the Astronomers. Now, Robert Jastrow, for a lot of intents and purposes, is on the border of being an agnostic. He doesn't really have any, you know, he doesn't have a dog to fight in this battle here. But this is what he says in the discovery of how the universe is expanding, because there's a lot of evidence that point to that. He says, now we see how the astronomical effects, evidence, leads to a biblical view of the origin of the world. He says, the details differ, but the essential elements in the astronomical and biblical accounts of Genesis are the same. Ain't that cool? The chain of events leading to man commenced suddenly and sharply as a definite moment in time, in a flash of light and energy. And yet, as when Moses put pen to paper, or papyrus, as he put the tradition, as he heard over and over of the beginning of the world, he wrote this down in Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The question is, who needs God? Well, something outside of time and space needed to initiate the creation sequence. So the start of the universe needs God. Now let me give you another evidence. Are we okay with evidence number two? You're like, I'm still worried on evidence number one. It's okay. Evidence number two, the design of the universe. This is one of my favorite ones. And when you look at the design of the universe and see where we are at the planet, I know you probably didn't think about that. You just went and dropped off your kids at soccer camp, and you went to go to, you know, get groceries at the store. You didn't think about this. But as we sit here, the only reason we even exist on Earth is because there's hundreds and hundreds of anthropic constants. Now, what is an anthropic principle? It's basically the universe must have those properties which allow life to develop within it. So there has to be a lot of anthropic constants in order for you and I to even exist here on this planet. And it's called the precision of the universe, or scientists call it the Goldilocks effect. Isn't that cool? It's not too hot, not too cold. It's just right, right? Not too firm, not too soft. It's just right. It's the Goldilocks effect. And I'm going to give you, there's hundreds of them, but you're not going to be able to sit through hundreds of them. I'm going to give you my favorite five. Number one, the Earth is comprised of 21% of the atmosphere. 21%. Any more, fires would spontaneously erupt. Any less, and humans would suffocate. So it's just at its perfect saturation of oxygen. The atmosphere transparency. I know there's a lot of debate about greenhouse gases and all that, but the atmosphere transparency, any more, if it was transparent, there would be too much solar radiation. Any less, and not enough solar radiation. And then the next one is the moon and earth gravitational interaction. If the placement of the moon was any closer, any further away, any more in tides and atmosphere and rotation, or if it was too close to the earth, it would be too severe to sustain life. Any less in orbital changes would create climate instabilities to sustain life. Also carbon dioxide. Any more and we would burn up and suffocate. Any less and plants could not sustain photosynthesis. Now, my favorite one of all. You ready for this one? Okay, good. Five people. All right. Gravity. Gravity. If the force of gravity were altered by this much, that's 0.37 zeros and 1%, we could not sustain life on this earth. That is just absolutely phenomenal. And one of my other favorites but didn't make the top five was Jupiter, the placement of Jupiter. If Jupiter was not the mass that it was and in the certain rotation, the planets have to be so aligned in this for even Earth to sustain life. And Jupiter is a huge contributor of that. And it's also pretty. You know, it's got a lot of colors and all that stuff. So an astronomer, Fred Hoyle, which by the way is an agnostic or atheist, he says, a common sense interpretation of the facts suggests that a super intellect, this is an atheist talking, a super intellect has monkeyed with physics as well as chemistry and biology, and that there are no blind forces worth speaking about in nature. Now, if you can't remember all this stuff, this is what basically the teleological argument says, that every design had a designer. The universe has a highly complex design. Therefore, the universe had a designer. And yet, you know what's so cool? Before they understood anthropic constants, before it was ever discovered, Paul, under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, wrote these wonderful words in Romans to these Christians in Rome. He says, for since the creation of the world, God's invisible quality, his internal power and divine nature have been, help me, clearly seen clearly seen. That being understood from what has been made so that people are without excuse. He says that God writes from the scriptures, but he also writes from a book of nature, and he reveals himself to us, and it can be clearly seen. So who needs God? Well, actually, the universe needs God, because something so complex, something so precise to even sustain life here on earth, the anthropic evidence alone weighs and points to the evidence of God. Are you ready for the third evidence? All right. The third evidence is the design of life. This is one of my favorite, because I love reading this book by Francis Collins. If you're thinking there that Christians, were not very smart and all that, can I tell you, Francis Collins is a Christian, and he was the head scientist on the Human Genome Project. So he's got enough degrees that he has more degrees than, I've read books. That's how many degrees he has. He wrote this amazing book called The Language of God, and he says, when they study the complexity of DNA, he says, such is the amazing complexity of the information carried within each cell of the human body. And each one of you have a DNA sequence that is only unique to you, that is only will ever be unique to you. I mean, that's just mind-blowing. And then he said this, that a live reading of the code, the code, the A, B, G, C, and all the different, the sequence, if you read that code at a rate of one letter per second, it would take you 31 years, even if reading continued day and night. Now, I don't suggest that you test me on that. It'll take you a long time to figure that out. But it's a long sequence. Your DNA. And he was blown away by this sequence that they finally mapped the genome. Now, this is an amazing thing. When someone says to you, you're one in a million, they're absolutely wrong. You're actually one in 300 million, by the way. And when your mom saw your dad and they both said, hey, something amazing. That's my rated G version, by the way. Something amazing happened. A biological construction project of intricacy and precision that began without any conscious direction from the father and mother. And when that egg was fertilized, hundreds of biological procedures took place automatically. I mean, just try to wrap your mind around that. And simultaneously involving, among other things, chromosomes, amino acids, proteins, DNAs, and cells dividing at a rate of, get this, 100,000 per second. No wonder if you're pregnant in here, no wonder you're tired all the time. I mean, that's a lot happening. Dr. Meyer said in his book, Signature in the Cell, he says DNA cannot be explained naturally. And he explains why he believes that. And it provides positive evidence for the prior activity of a designing intelligence. He says something, because how can the blind forces of nature create a software code? He says it doesn't explain. But if you were to talk to an atheist, the only explanation they would come up with is macroevolution. And if you're like, well, Justin, what's macroevolution? Well, that's good to you via the zoo. That's macroevolution. I'm not trying to poke fun, but that's in a sense what it is. There I understand, creatures adapting and all that, but macroevolution, jumping from species, I have a hard time believing. And it's not because of that, because of some of the evidence that I've read even for myself, not just because the Bible said so. DNA by itself could not, and this is true for you as I begin to dig into this, DNA by itself could not produce complex cells into organs. It needs a new thing they discovered. Well, it's not new for us, but around 1940, they discovered a new information strand called epigenetics. This is something I just recently came upon, and they're really, really digging into the level of understanding about what epigenetics is all about. Well, what is epigenetics? Well, it explains this question. How did certain cells know to become heart cells while others knew to become brain cells? How do they know? And again, you have the DNA, but DNA by itself can't produce those complex organs. You need another line of information directing the DNA through epigenetics. It's information. It directs the cells in the process of development. Now, let me explain to you kind of in a fifth grader, because this is how I needed to be explained what epigenetics are. I'm like, epa what? You know? So epigenetics, if we were to put, if this was you, if your life was a movie, if your life was a movie, the cells in your body would be the actors. The script would be the DNA. But epigenetics, every movie needs a director, right? I mean, you don't have E.T. without Steven Spielberg, all right? I mean, you have to have something that directs the actors through the script. And that is the goal-directed information. Now, you're sitting there going, well, why does this even matter? Listen to me. This is one of the things that is so key and just one evidence why I don't believe in macroevolution. It's because, one of the reasons is because of epigenetics. And here's the reason. They did some tests with these embryos because now we can manipulate DNA now. I don't know if you knew this, gene therapy and all that. They can manipulate DNA. And they would manipulate DNA of these, this biologist, Jonathan Wells, would manipulate the DNA from a fruit fly embryo. And so what they're trying to do, they're trying to mutate those DNA to come up with something else, right? And then so as they did that, they successfully manipulated the DNA strand and manipulated the genes, but here's the results of what they said. And the problem they kept running into was epigenetics. He says this, Jonathan Wells, remarkably, although interference may introduce deformities, so when they would manipulate DNA, there would be deformities, the basic endpoint of development never changes. He says, if they survive, if the embryo survives, fruit flies always become fruit flies. Frog eggs always become frogs, and mouse eggs always become mice. Not even the species changes. And then he says, every embryo is somehow, epigenetics explains this, programmed to develop into a particular species of animal. He says, no matter what we do to a fruit fly embryo, there are only three possible outcomes: a normal fruit fly, a defective fruit fly, or a dead fruit fly. Not even a horse fly, much less even a horse. And this is the problem. And if you dive into this, this is so fascinating. When they would manipulate the DNA strand, the epigenetics would kick in and go, that's not the script, and they would try to correct what was manipulated. I'm just like, wow. And yet, thousands and thousands of years ago, David said this in Psalms 139, for you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. I tell you how, remember I told you how I got on this band about 14 years ago about learning about this stuff? Because of this guy, Anthony Flew. In 2004, Anthony Flew was a prolific philosophy guru and journalist, and he was a devout atheist. For 50 years, he wrote articles. He's a brilliant mind. But in 2004, he said, with the evidence of the DNA, I can no longer believe that there is no God. He said, after 50 years of writing, he says, I have now believed that there is a God. And when I read that book several years ago, about 12 years ago, when I read that book, I was so just caught off guard. I was like, wow. Someone like him needed evidence to stare at him right in his face, but he was objective enough to see the evidence and reconsider. And this is his words, Anthony Flew, amazing. What I think the DNA material has done is that it has shown by the utmost unbelievable complexity the arrangement which are needed to produce life. That intelligence must have been involved in getting these extraordinary diverse elements to work together. So who needs God? Biology. Needs God. Now, if you're sitting there thinking, no, well, okay, Justin. Anthony was probably coming to the end of his life, and he's probably doing this as like kind of a deathbed confession, and that's not the case. In fact, Anthony Flew did not become a Christian. Unfortunately, the evidence just led him to the point where he believed that God existed, but he wasn't willing to go any further with that revelation. And so this is not an, you know, a deathbed confession here of recounting what he said. This is something he says, I saw the evidence, and after 50 years of being a prolific atheist, a philosophy and journalist writer, I decided that there is a God. That's why the psalmist said in 19:1, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the skies proclaim the work of his hand. Isn't that wonderful? That when you're 5 years old, you're looking up at the stars, that awe and wonder, you don't have all the background and all the understanding knowledge, you're just like, wow. That awe and wonder, that the stars proclaim the glory, the works of his hands. Now, don't take my word for it. I'm a preacher, all right? I'm biased. I get it. I love Jesus, and I want everyone to know Jesus, right? But I want you to take Robert Jastrow's words in the book, God and the Astronomers. And he said this, for the scientist who has lived by his faith in the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He says he has scaled the mountains of ignorance, and he is about to conquer the highest peak as he pulls himself over the final rock. So he's just doing this beautiful picture that he's just kind of crawling. He says humanity is advancing at all kinds of speeds in its understanding of science and biology and astronomy. And it's advancing and it's going over to the final rock. And as he pulls himself up, he says, he is greeted by a band of theologians who have been sitting there for centuries. How cool is that? It's true. God does reveal himself through two books, the Bible and the book of nature. I'm here just to look at the complexity. And as Christians, we shouldn't be scared of science. We shouldn't be scared of science and say, I mean, understand it. Everyone has a biasness. But we should allow what we've discovered to allow us to see how complex and how amazing really God made the world. And it is true, isn't it? The heavens do declare the glory of God, and the skies proclaim the works of his hand.